Races of Britain by John Beddow. Part 6. The Danish Period. We have now followed the history of the Saxon conquest of Britain down to the period about the middle of the 9th century, when the invasions of the Vikings, commonly comprehended under the name of Danish, began to be really formidable, and when the westward progress of Anglo-Saxon conquest and colonisation was checked by the necessity of defence against these assailants. The operations of the Northmen, as they affected the ethnology of England, might be thus distinguished. A. The great invasions and settlements of the latter part of the 9th century, which resulted in the establishment of the Danelaw. B. The renewed invasions in the reign of Ethelred II and the conquest of all England by Sven Forkbeard and Canute. C. The comparatively obscure colonisation by the Norwegians from Ireland, the Isle of Man, the Hebrides and Cumbria, and some other parts of the northwest. D. The gradual infiltration of Northmen, singly or in small bands, as warriors, merchants and seamen. And E. The colonisation of Scotland and Ireland may be taken later. We'll start with A. We have no certain data whereon to found an estimate of the numbers of the Scandinavian invaders, the rapidity of the movements of their hosts, and the ease with which they obtained horses, in number sufficient for their purposes, give us the idea of small bands of buccaneers rather than of important national migrations. Moreover, it is difficult to understand how the denizens of three countries, one of which was small, the second mostly uninhabitable, and the third certainly then as now thinly peopled, could have furnished a sufficient number of fighting men to maintain incessant broils at home, while they were plundering the whole coasts of Europe, peopling Iceland, Shetland, and Orkney, together with cities, provinces, and islands in Great Britain, Ireland, and France, and acquiring a great and sometimes preponderant influence in the politics of all these countries, as well as of Russia. All this they did within a short space of time, as may easily be allowed for the Saxon conquest of Lothian and the eastern half of England, a fact which goes far to do away with the argument on the insufficiency of Old Saxony to furnish a new population to these latter countries. The numbers of the ships are sometimes given with an exactness that almost demands belief, and as we have some evidence as to their size and complement of men, we feel obliged to acknowledge that some of the invading armies may have included many thousands of warriors. The destruction of life through their means among the English must have been very great, and the chronicle speaks of the mortality among cattle and men during their operations as though it had been much greater than the actual slaughter. We are told that they divided the lands of Deira and tilled and sowed them, which latter clause seems to imply that they were too numerous to constitute a mere military aristocracy, and that they must have formed a considerable portion of the population where they permanently settled. Moreover, they in some expeditions brought their wives and children with them, and their thralls also, which again throws additional light on the probable character of the Anglo-Saxon immigration. It was during this first period of Danish aggression that the counties of York, Lincoln, Nottinghamshire, Leicester, Norfolk and Suffolk assumed the Scandinavian character which the first four ever afterwards retained, and which strongly tinctured East Anglia thenceforward. Some other counties, as Derby, Northampton, and Cambridge, received also a considerable military population of Danes. Northumberland, Durham, and Lothian, though subdued by Halfdan, were little interfered with subsequently, and were generally left under earls of Anglian descent. The Scandinavian element in Yorkshire must have been greatly strengthened during the early part of the 10th century by the invasions of Ragnald and the two Olafs. Still, it would be difficult to explain the history of the Danelaw during this period without allowing something for the somewhat nearer relation in language and blood between the Anglians and Danes than between the latter and the men of Wessex. B. The great Danish and Norwegian invasions in the days of Ethelred II and the rule of the Danish sovereigns subsequently must have introduced a good deal of fresh northern blood, but there is little indication of the invaders having anywhere settled down in large masses as in the 9th century. Perhaps the small Danish settlement about Lidford, which Taylor asserts on the evidence of local names, may have taken place about this time. But in the main, the effect of these later invasions was not so great from an ethnological as from a political point of view. A good deal of land, however, in Wessex and the West, as well as elsewhere, passed into the hands of Danish holders, the names of whose sons appear in the Domesday Book. C. The colonisation of the western coast by Scandinavians, chiefly Norwegians, from the Hebrides, the Isle of Man, and the cities of the Ostmen in Ireland, which are Dublin, Waterford and Wexford, is, considering its importance and the late period at which it must have taken place, singularly obscure. Respecting the settlement about Milford Haven, we have, I believe, no evidence at all, except that of certain local names, as those of Milford, Haverford, Langham, Haraldston, and the islands of Caldy, Skokholm, and Skoma, though the Annales Cambriae and the Bruti Turisogion repeatedly, under the 10th century, mention the devastation of Menevia and Duffet by the pagans. The settlement of Cumberland, Westmorland, Furness, and eastern Dumfriesshire has been studied by Ferguson, who is of opinion that it must have been affected from the Isle of Man. The facts we have to deal with are these. 1. The history of southern Cumbria, the modern Cumberland and Westmorland, remains very obscure after the 7th century, when we know that it was under Northumbrian sway. Edred, an Anglian, ruled at Carlisle in 918, but the population may have been still largely British, while the country lay very open to the raids of the Norsemen. 2. AD 945, Cumberland and Strathclyde, we are told, were harried with fire and sword by King Edmund, their king Dunmail, Domnall or Dunwallon, expelled from the former, if not from the latter region, and the country granted to the king of the Scots to be held of the English crown. We may presume that the land was still sparsely inhabited. 3. AD 1000, or 1000, Ethelred II invades Cumberland. Ubi decorum maxima mentio, says Henry of Huntingdon, and wastes the country. 4. When Malcolm Canmore ravaged Northumbria and swept away a great part of the remaining population of Yorkshire into slavery, Cumberland and Westmorland were his, and the Cumbrians doubtless formed part of his army. Moreover, Cumberland was the nearest and safest refuge for the Anglo-Danes of Yorkshire when they were fleeing from the wrath of William the Bastard. 5. Dolphin, son of Cospatrick, was Earl of Cumberland till William Rufus expelled him, but Waltheof, his brother, retained extensive lordships therein. William introduced a colony of Saxons from the south, whom he settled in and around Carlisle. 6. We find the local names of Cumberland, Westmoreland, Furness, Lonsdale, Annandale, and Eskdale, for the most part Teutonic, and rather Scandinavian than Saxon, rather Norse than Danish. The dialect is strongly tinctured with Norse characteristics, and the people, while bearing a certain degree of resemblance to the modern Strathclydewalians, in stature and feature, approach more nearly, I think, in these respects, to the Norwegians, with whom they also agree in being remarkably fair. 7. Man, the Isle of Man, was in the possession of the Norsemen for several centuries, and they have left their mark on the local names, customs, and laws of the island, but the language and the physical character of the people are Celtic to this day, though doubtless somewhat modified. Cumberland lies opposite to Man and is a much more fertile and desirable land. We may suppose, therefore, that a continual stream of Norse colonisation poured during the 10th and 11th centuries into the half-deserted mainland, to which Man may have served as a kind of stepping stone, while the native Manxmen held strongly to their island home and there perpetuated their race. D. The influence of this infiltration may have been considerable in the maritime counties and the principal towns. Indications of it crop up everywhere. Thus in London we have Tooley Street and the Church of St. Olaf and the word Hustings, which seems to have been taken from the speech of London into the common stock of English, and in the Bristol Channel we have the steep and the flat holm and Worm's Head. The more Celtic portions of South Britain were perhaps more affected in this way than the remainder, for the Danes and Norwegians frequently took service with the Welsh and Cornish chiefs during their revolts against the English or their struggles with each other. Icelandic sagas represent the Norsemen as familiar with the Welsh havens and markets. For example, in the Njal saga, Cole, one of the burners of Njal's house, is accidentally encountered and slain by the avenger Kari in the market of a Welsh port, where Cole, we are told, was about to marry an heiress of the country. We may now proceed to examine the evidence of the progress of Saxonisation along the Western Marches during the period under review. Evidence derived chiefly, but not altogether, from the Domesday Book. The Ordinance respecting the Dynastas in Thorpe's Ancient Laws is here of considerable importance. Palgrave and Dr. Nicholas following him read Devonsetters and suppose the document to be a treaty between the Saxon and the British Devonians, and the latter, a misunderstanding Palgrave, fixes its date about 15 years before the Norman conquest. It is clear, and shall be presently shown, that at that time the Exe and even the Tamar, both rivers, had ceased to be a national boundary in a political sense. But as the treaty first appears in a manuscript of the 10th century, it may really date from the time when the Devonians west of the Exe were still half independent. Thorpe, however, shows that the reading Devonsetters occurs only in Lambard and not uniformly even there, and I follow him in thinking that some expressions referring to the Wentsetters, i.e. probably the inhabitants of the Forest of Dean, which the Welsh reckoned as the easternmost of three Gwents, are almost conclusive in favour of the treaty being one between the English and the Welsh, or rather the people under English and Welsh law respectively on the two sides of the Wye. Though the West Welsh had for centuries, Palgrave thinks, from the time of Geraint II in AD 589, but this is doubtful, formed a state, which was usually, or at least frequently, vassal to Wessex, and though their frequent struggles for liberty always ended in a further contraction of their frontier, they had still, in Æthelstan's day, their native Prince Howel, whose jurisdiction did not, however, at all events after AD 938, extend east of the Tamar. It must have been later than this when the Saxons acquired the property of the greater part of the soil of Cornwall, which they clearly had under Edward the Confessor. Of the king's thanes and tenants enumerated in the Domesday Book, both before and after the conquest, after eliminating the Normans and their Breton allies, the great majority have Saxon names. There are a few Welsh ones in both counties. Thus, in Cornwall, Griffin holds Roscarnin and Jovin, probably a Breton. And there are several names, such as Wallow, Collow, Chinesi, Brettel, Vuddle, Wasso, Offals, Blowin, Merkin, Jawl, Andreas, Bleshu, and Rabble, respecting the nationality of which I am doubtful, but some of which are probably Welsh. In Devonshire, Llachelyn or Llewellyn holds Withacnoll of Godbold, and the names of Levitt, Wordron, Edludieg, Chenias, Ludo and Wichin are to me more or less doubtful. There are no other exceptions. In Kemble, Volume 1, Appendix C, are some interesting manumissions from the Book of St. Petrox, Bodmin, dating from the latter half of the 10th century. In these, the priests and freemen have some Saxon and some Cornish names, but those of the slaves, with hardly an exception, are clearly Cornish. On the whole, it is safe to conclude that at the time of the Norman conquest, the landholders in the whole of West Wales were generally Saxon, but that the bulk of the population was Celtic, Logrian, not only in blood, but in speech, throughout Cornwall, and a great part of South Devon, at the very least. It may be worth consideration whether the high physical and intellectual average of the Cornish people may not be partly due to their having in their veins a double portion of the blood of the old Romano-British chiefs and military class, for it is natural to suppose that as the West Welsh were driven back step by step, the chiefs and fighting men would abandon their lands and take refuge with their countrymen further back, while the servile class would remain on the soil and accept easily the rule of their new and alien lords. The Domesday yields much valuable information respecting the population of the Welsh marches. It is evident that Offa had succeeded in rendering the north-eastern bank of the Wye up to near the present frontier English, in a certain sense, but the south-western bank, below the same point, including the district of Archenfield, though subject to the King of England, was to a great extent under Welsh customary law, and the same was the case with certain territories in the eastern part of Monmouthshire, which had been annexed by Harold Godwinson. The king had 96 free tenants, evidently Welshmen, in Archenfield, who held carracates, served in the army, and paid 41 sesterces of honey and 20 shillings in lieu of sheep. A few Welshmen are mentioned on the left bank of the Wye. Thus, one Griffin had half a hide in Pion, near Webley, and in one instance, a Welshman holds as under-tenant land formerly belonging to Edward, an Englishman. Evidently, the Forest of Dean was still Welsh to some extent. Thus, Morgan held Bicknoffra, English Bicknor, in Edward the Confessor's time, and Madoc, a king's thane, held and still holds Rudford, a few miles west of Gloucester. It is noteworthy here, and in Herefordshire, that Welshmen are occasionally found dwelling on or even holding parishes having English names. Thus, Cecil holds Stanton, Staunton-on-Wye, above Hereford, also that the English names were in some instances very recent. Thus, Brismer held a Brismerfrum of Earl Harold, and had evidently given the estate his own name. The same mixture of Welshmen and Englishmen continues all along the western border of Shropshire, and Welsh under-tenants are met with in parishes bearing English names, as Whittington and Ossulston. The Welshmen, mentioned as such, were probably all freemen, and when we read that in Clune, 8 villains, 2 Welshmen and 4 boarders hold 2 caricates among them, we need not conclude that all the villains and boarders were English. I have quoted these particulars from the Domesday to show that the ancestors of the population of the Marches were certainly to some extent Welsh, even in the 11th century, although its modern representatives have entirely forgotten the fact, and while bearing in their features, complexion and moral character evident marks of their descent, affect sometimes to be English of the English. The period of the Norse invasions and migrations was as important in Scotch as well as in English history, and was more protracted, for it may be said to have hardly ceased until the Battle of Largs in 1261, or at the earliest until the establishment of Somerled as ruler of the Hebrides about 1150. But there, as in England, the great invasions of the 9th century were ethnologically the most important. They made the Norwegians rulers of the Shetlands, the Orkneys, the Hebrides, and Man, and from that time forth the coasts of Scotland were vexed by their perpetual raids, while their chiefs at various times subdued and exercised dominion over Caithness and other portions of the mainland. These hostile relations did not prevent frequent intermarriage between the ruling families of Norsemen and Picts, or Scots as they are henceforth called, and probably there was a like admixture of blood among other classes. Shetland, Orkney and Caithness accepted the Norse language, and in Shetland especially, very little Pictish blood appears to have remained to blend with that of the conquerors. In the Hebrides, the latter were evidently less numerous in proportion, but in many of the islands they were able to take a very large, and in the Lewis, the largest, share in fixing the local nomenclature, though they could not root their language permanently in the speech of the people. There are also points on the western coast where the Norse element has evidently survived in considerable force. There was a period, the middle of the 11th century, when Thorfinn, Earl of Orkney, ruled over the eastern coast, as far southward as the Tay. But as the local names in Buchan, Angus, and the Mearns are almost all either of Celtic or of modern Scottish type, we must suppose that the undoubtedly strong infusion of Norse blood in those quarters must have been of later introductions, probably coeval with the comparatively peaceful and silent Anglo-Danish and Flemish colonisation which followed the Norman conquest. The contemporary history of Ireland, from our point of view, resembled that of Scotland as much as the different geographical conditions would allow. There too, Danish and Norwegian raids and invasions began early in the 9th century. There too, points of vantage were speedily mastered by the invaders, but in the case of Ireland, there were no large outlying islands placed conveniently for them, except that of Man, and they accordingly seized on the best harbours and ports, those especially of Dublin, Waterford, Wexford, Cork, and Limerick, and utilised them for their mixed military, piratical, and commercial colonisation. There too, their dominion occasionally extended over a great perhaps the greater part, of the whole country. There, too, their military energy declined with the slackening of the flow of immigration from the north after the Battle of Clontarf, and still more after the defeat and death of Magnus Barefoot towards the end of the 11th century. We have the same evidence of frequent intermarriage, but the Northmen nowhere perpetuated their language, or if they did so, in some of the ports, it merged into the English introduced by the Anglo-Norman conquest of the next century. They fixed but few local names beyond those of the harbours they frequented, but they left traces of their personal names among the people, and, in my opinion, permanently modified the breed of man in certain districts.